Hi, I'm DJ. This is the thing, though. When I was thinking about it, I was like, we don't have a pre-made, like, opening.
Oh, man. Whenever you're ready.
Hi, I'm DJ.
And I'm Winfred. And this week, to make sure that Women's History Month got started correctly and to put a focus on Black women, rightfully, of course, Rachel Dolezal changed her name to a West African Igbo name that I'm not even going to try to pronounce.
We should all learn how to pronounce it because she has a book coming out. Duly noted.
All right, before we hop into this week's noteworthy, how was your week? Anything new, different, exciting?
Just another week of feeling the effects of global warming, honestly. I feel like I say that a lot on this show now.
I'm telling you, March in New England really is a difficult time. Here in Houston, we actually are experiencing something because there's never a chill in Houston in March. Let me see, anything this week? No. So oddly enough, I had a coworker tell me that it was rude that I did not mention that last Sunday was my birthday to them until Monday.
Wow. I'm like,
excuse me, what? Is that a thing? What?
See, as your co-host, I should have probably started this show off by saying, hey, Winfred, happy belated birthday.
No, you said it last week. You guys didn't hear last week. We should address that real quick. So last week we did a recording. Technical difficulties have plagued my life since we have decided to start publishing these episodes. Now, I would like people to know that we have been recording since October. And we have been recording every week since October, trying to perfect a structure and the flow of the show and all that jazz, and never once had an issue with the tech and editing afterwards.
Yes, fun fact, audience, we have been recording since the weekend of my birthday.
Correct. Now, since we have decided to start publishing the episodes, every time I go to edit the episodes, there is some sort of technical difficulty. This week, the tech beat me. That will not happen again, I pray. So y'all didn't hear what we recorded last week after I had completely edited the episode from start to bottom. Or top to bottom, start to finish. Point is, there were technical difficulties that precluded you from getting last week's episode, in which DJ told me happy birthday on my birthday, and I spent the time recording on my birthday only to not be able to publish that episode. But it's cool. It's whatever. It's done.
Well,
I guess that was my duly noted. Hell.
Well, hey. We have to find some vengeance for your lost time. So that was fine. I'm glad you got to get that out of your system.
Yes,
because you weren't the only one who was like hella frustrated last Sunday.
Who else was hella frustrated?
Well, I think the cast, production crew, anyone who was supporting Moonlight was frustrated. Anyone who met with the Trump administration was frustrated. And just anyone who tried to, you know, do some good for Black people, including you, for our Black podcast, just ended up being very frustrated by the end of this week. So where would you even like to start?
Let's start with the Oscars. This year, we had a slew of Black nominees. Happy to see Viola Davis take home the Oscar for Best Supporting Actress. Happy to see Mahershala Ali take home the Oscar for Best Supporting Actor. With Viola Davis's win, she in fact becomes the first Black actress to receive an Oscar, an Emmy, and a Tony, all for acting. Now, Whoopi Goldberg herself is an EGOT, has an Emmy, Grammy, Oscar, and a Tony, But her Tony was for producing, not for acting. So that is the point of difference there. But then the best film thing happened.
Yeah, and who do we blame for that moment? Or should we blame anyone for that moment?
Technically, we're supposed to blame PricewaterhouseCoopers.
Who have apologized since the flub happened.
Yes, but I don't know that I want to blame anybody because this moment was retribution for like November for me.
I think it's just another example of how whether we're in hidden fences of racism or racism is out in the open, there is just some like lack of caring when it comes to recognizing Black films, films of color, and recognizing Black people just as a whole properly. Properly. Because they did, at the end of the day, Moonlight did win Best Picture, but I'm pretty sure most people are going to remember the like hundreds of people who were going on and off the stage for about, you know, a good 4 to 5 minutes.
Moonlight won. Even though it happened the way that it did, I was happy to see Moonlight win. And damn near was kind of happy to see it happen in that way, to see them go up on stage and take that trophy and put it in their melanin-rich hands of their own.
Well, unfortunately, I think on Tuesday of this week, we have pretty much come to the conclusion that that won't be happening for us in terms of the U.S. with our president. Our president is Donald Trump. President Trump gave a
joint address. I need you constantly remind us of that fact. People know it already.
The president of the United States did a joint address to Congress where he gave some of his early plans on what he will be trying to achieve in the next 4 years, including overhauling Obamacare, adding more jobs to our economy, and, you know, any other thing that he could remember from what Steve Bannon told him, pretty much.
In this speech, Trump got to sound what he all he did. And there was a fantastic quote that I meant to look up before we started recording, and I'm sitting here kicking myself for it. People gave him all the credit in the world for sounding quote-unquote presidential and not being so bombastic or so aggressive in his tone and style and blase, blase. But even his aides, like the people who work in the White House, have been quoted for saying things like, they're surprised at how much credit the media is giving him for simply using an inside voice, but not changing his content. They're surprised at how the media, he didn't change anything. He just said it differently, which is oh, so very true, because in this speech, it's not like Donald Trump tempered his policy prescriptions. He just used a more measured tone. And if that's all it takes, it's a scary time in America. That said, he's already returned back to his bombastic ways. But so a couple Lord, I wanted to say a couple of months ago, he signed an executive order because it feels like he's been in there for at least a year at this point. This man has been in there for 6 weeks. So last month, he signed an executive order that required the Department of Homeland Security to publish on a weekly basis all crimes committed by undocumented individuals. Let that sink in for a moment. Okay. And so in this address, he gave a name to this. He calls it VOICE, Victims of Immigrant Crime Engagements. But he said it in a way that almost sounded normal. Fortunately, when he said the name of this initiative, the Democrats in the room audibly gasped, like, what the actual hell? Did he just say that for real?
And I could put money down that the Republicans in the audience, like they did for many of his newly planned, I don't even call it, plans for our government to fail. The Republican response to many of his initiatives that he has in queue were just cheers, like waves of cheers erupting every time he announced one of these new initiatives, whether it be voice or his announcing that the Keystone Pipeline would continue, the construction of that would continue. The Republican Party made sure that, you know, they were that parent in the background of their child, you know, taking all the shots but missing all of them, but they were still just waves and waves of cheers for everything Trump said. So while Trump's performance might have been a bit, you know, low-key compared to his just everyday performance as our president during this speech, I believe the Republicans surely made up for it with their response to every pause that he gave them.
Trump in this speech said things that are just diametrically opposed to his actions. So he said that he wants to protect the environment. I mean, it was one line, but he said it was a priority. That said, he has already undone environmental regulations and is handicapping the EPA and put over the EPA a guy who does not believe in the EPA and is currently suing the EPA and also does not believe that man contributes to climate change.
He came up with a lot of stats that I didn't necessarily understand, and I was hoping maybe you, with your political knowledge, could maybe unpack them. So when it came to, you know, speaking about the economy, he addressed that we have had the worst financial recovery in 65 years. When I hear financial recovery, I think, well, that's a positive thing. I guess the worst part of a financial recovery would be that you added millions of jobs back in like two terms, or you stopped the bleeding of millions of jobs in two terms. Is there a better financial recovery?
So what he should have said that would have been, or perhaps what he was citing that would make that statement partially true, is that the recovery was one of the slowest in terms of annual GDP year to year, which is very inside baseball economics. But while we added jobs rather steadily, what we did not do was have a big spike in new jobs to replace those that were lost, and then a continuation of a smaller amount of new jobs being added every month. We just had a steady drumbeat of new jobs and not the big splash followed by the steady drumbeat. So there is some truth to that. If that is in fact what he was trying to cite. Now, Donald Trump could have very well just been saying whatever sounds good to Donald Trump.
Right after Trump's speech, I was on Twitter, you know, getting my tweets in, getting my hashtags in. Then I saw like another story start to overtake.
At Duly Noted Show.
Yes, that is our podcast handle for all of you who are not following it. And as I was tweeting from at Duly Noted Show on Twitter, if you all didn't catch that, I saw Jeff Sessions just pop up on my trending topic.
So our top law enforcer in the country has perjured himself. I don't care how the media tries to say it nicely. I don't know why the media still feels compelled to soften language about lies in court or out of court when the language that the Trump administration is lobbying at them is certainly strong, curt, and to the point. Jeff Sessions perjured himself in his hearing confirmations because he was under oath. First of all, he voluntarily called himself a Trump surrogate. Okay? So Senator Al Franken asked him whether or not he or any other member of the Trump campaign had had contact with Russia. And he said that he was a campaign surrogate and that he had not had any contact with Russia, which, okay, cool. You say that, we take you at your word because you're under oath and we just like assume that you're not going to lie. That said, we then learned that wasn't the case. He, in fact, met with the Russian ambassador on two separate occasions. Once at the Republican National Convention, the Trump campaign paid for him to be there. Okay. What Jeff Sessions has tried to say is that he met with the ambassador as a senator and not as a surrogate, because as a senator, it's his job to do so. Jeff Sessions is on the Armed Services Committee, all right? Not a single other member of the Armed Services Committee in the House or the Senate has met with the Russian ambassador. Doesn't happen. That's something that the Foreign Relations Committee might do, but not the Armed Services. So shut that down. We also know that the Trump campaign paid for you to have this meeting. So shut that down. So, yes, you met with him. You did so as a surrogate. So you lied, but you did so under oath. So that's perjury. So the top law enforcer in the country has perjured himself. Now, he has recused himself for dealing with investigations pertaining to the campaign's involvement with Russia. But he does not need to be recusing. He needs to be resigning, because the man is the top law enforcer in the country and he perjured himself. So not only should he resign, but perjury is
it's an offense
for which people get locked up. That's a crime. Yes,
it is. Politicians such as Nancy Pelosi, the minority House leader, have called for Jeff Sessions to, you know, resign. And then Trump stepped in and said, no, no, no. We should be investigating Chuck Schumer and Nancy Pelosi for their close ties with the Russian officials. In their meetings with the Russian officials, and Donald Trump provided a picture of the of a meeting, so-called meeting with Pelosi and the Russian diplomat, excuse me, ambassador.
Okay.
It seems like they've met at a dinner. And again, we have to remember that Nancy Pelosi is one of the top members of the House.
I mean, she is the top Democrat in the House. So I will say this, okay, if black and brown kids were given the same benefit of the doubt that Republican politicians were, our community would be so very different. Because with Chris Christie and Bridgegate, everybody around him could know about what was going on. And everybody around him could be involved. But Chris Christie could feign that he knew nothing, and he is still currently the sitting governor of New Jersey.
Isn't that the same situation with the governor of Michigan and the Flint water crisis?
Yes. Everybody around him could be blamed, the EPA director, this and that. But he was the one who made the decision to use a different water source because it was cheaper. But he's not to blame. Now, Trump, everybody around him can be involved with, in contact with, regularly communicating with Russia, but he knows nothing. He's removed. If guilty by association is no longer a thing, we need to let out about 2/3 of black and brown incarcerated folk. Because being an accomplice is a criminal act. I am befuddled is all I got. I don't even have words. I just don't understand.
Well, we'll touch on, you know, the releasing of black and brown people later on in the show. However, Trump's excuse could be that because he's been too busy doing his community outreach to the blacks, he really hasn't had time to, you know, review what his cabinet is doing. They do what they do, and he does what he does, and that's how they get things done. You gotta remember, we gotta get things done. So this week, President Trump met with the presidents of the HBCUs, those are historically black colleges, to what, you know, at least Morehouse president believed was going to be an announcement of increased funding. And it seems like that wasn't the case from a recent letter that the president of Morehouse released. From a statement that President John Wilson Jr. of Morehouse made to his college, he stated that when he first received this invite and when the other presidents of HBCUs received their invite, they thought it was going to be an announcement about increasing federal funding to HBCUs, considering that President Obama had invested $3 billion more dollars into HBCUs in his first 6 years than President Bush invested in his final 6 years. So, of course, they all gathered, you know, on Capitol Hill. They met with, you know, many representatives, probably from, you know, the states of where their colleges are located. Apparently met with some people in Trump's cabinet.
Yeah, met with Pence ass, met with Steve Bannon ass, and met with Kellyanne Conway on her knees on the couch ass.
What it seems like, what I gather from the entire event, was that they just came there to take a picture with the president. It was kind of like,
that's exactly what the hell they did.
Let's all get on the bus and go to Washington, D.C. Or if you're Howard, you just walk there, maybe take a car. But, you know, it was like a field trip to see the Capitol, pretty much. Mm-hmm. And, you know, meet with the president, take a picture.
That was it. This whole meeting was a photo op that I think a number of black people who, at least I know, who have said, well, at least Trump has a 10-point plan for black folk. Did Obama ever have a 10-point plan? What did Obama do for black people? Okay. So for all of those people, they're going to be able to point back to this picture the same way Trump and Spicer incorrectly pointed back to the size of the inauguration crowd picture. They're going to incorrectly point back to this picture of these HBCU presidents in the Oval Office and go, look, see, look. But wait, look. And I'm going to say, now tell me what the hell happened. They're probably going to say that they got more money. I can almost guarantee that they're going to say that they got more money. And that's going to be an incorrect statement. Need our listeners to understand that all that happened was they came there and they took a picture. And Trump signed an executive order that did jack diddly squat regarding what they came there for.
Is it crazy to think that a rapper who has the phrase "the rapper" in his name?
Please say the rapper, in fact.
Chance the Rapper, in fact, probably had a better takeaway, albeit probably a similar takeaway from his meeting with Governor Bruce Rauner of Illinois than HBCU presidents, like presidents of prestigious institutions, had with the actual president of the United States, that maybe Chance had a better reaction, in my opinion.
It's not crazy because I think the HBCU presidents, I don't know, they left and still had like hope that they hadn't been hoodwinked and bamboozled and invited literally to just come take a picture until it was confirmed that they had been, because they were not privy to the content of the executive order until it was released afterwards.
Well, in the meeting on Friday with the Illinois governor, Rauner, Chance the Rapper, they did kind of have a subject at hand, very similar, that one would think very similar to the meeting with Trump and the HBCU presidents, and that was funding for education. Last year in Chicago, there was a $200 million funding proposal for the public school system, and it was vetoed late last year. Chance found this very troubling, as do many Chicagoans. And he went to meet with the Illinois governor to just try to figure out, you know, how we can, you know, re-budget things and rework things so, you know, you won't end up with a failing school system. And from Chance's response outside of the meeting place, we can kind of get a sense that it didn't go as he thought prior to the meeting. After his meeting with the Illinois governor, Chance was met by many, you know, photographers and news outlets. And he, you know, kind of lashed out at the news outlets for, you know, putting more attention around the fact that a rapper who had just won a Grammy without a record label was meeting with the Illinois governor, instead of putting attention around the backstory, as he said. And I found that to be very poignant.
Yeah, I agree. There are so many reasons to love Chancellor Bennett, because he is just, he's doing a lot for, I feel like he really is trying to put Chicago and now I guess Illinois on his back, and I respect him for that hustle. I love the fact that Chance the Rapper is meeting with the Illinois governor. Chance is honing his attention where I think it is best used these days, which is focusing on state and local level politics and governance. For our side note this week, and this side note is not uplifting.
Well, it might not be uplifting, but it is very informative. So this week,
it's informative and necessary. I'm not saying it's not needed.
It is definitely necessary. And it's surprising as well, considering the source it's coming from. So
it really is.
Spike TV partnered with the Weinstein Company and Jay-Z, another rapper, is airing a 6-part mini documentary series on the life of Kalief Browder entitled Time, the Kalief Browder story. Now, if you're not familiar with the Kalief Browder case, Kalief Browder was a teenager who was arrested in New York City for robbery. He spent 3 years on Rikers Island, which is one of the most notorious prisons in the United States history. 2 of those 3 years that he spent on Rikers were in solitary confinement. And to top it all off, he was never convicted of any crime.
I'm going to have to let you be the person to continue talking about this side note, or we will talk about it for forever.
No problem. So the first episode of the documentary, when I was kind of more familiar with the case, there might be a few people out there who are, due to the attention it got from, you know, people like Jay-Z getting involved, because before his untimely death, he was planning a case against the New York City Police Department because he was held in confinement and never convicted. But the reason he was held so long was because his case was postponed a ridiculous 31 times. And the first episode of the documentary, it touches on many things that pretty much led to his death, starting with him being born in the crack epidemic, his mother being a abuser of crack cocaine, him and his brothers being placed in a very faulty Department of Human Resources adoption, I don't want to call it ring, but honestly, a system that was just so broken at the time and still is. And from that point on, just being a juvenile black male, trying to be a kid in the city and facing the things that many juvenile black males faced, especially in New York City with the stop and frisk program. which pretty much led to his arrest.
Yeah. So Khalif would not take a plea deal because he was not guilty of the crime that he had been accused of, not convicted of, the crime that he had been accused of. Okay. So because he would not take the plea deal and could not post bail, this young man was held in Rikers, like Rikers.
As a teen, he was not an adult.
As a teenager.
Because in the state of New York, they consider 16-year-olds to be eligible for adult charges.
Held at Rikers at 16, from 16 to 19, 3 years, never convicted, wouldn't take a plea deal. 2 of those years, he was in solitary confinement.
And solitary confinement was supposedly created for punishment of a prisoner beyond incarceration. And it's usually stated to be for violations of prison regulations or protection against for vulnerable inmates. So they probably argued that, hey, you know, this kid has had some history of mental health issues. He's a kid. He's a child among men. And not that there aren't other, you know, teens on Rikers Island. There, you know, there are more Khalif Browders that we know about, sadly. But for him to be placed in solitary confinement for 2 of the 3 years that he was not convicted of stealing a backpack.
Stealing a backpack. Okay, so over the past couple of years, DJ pointed out to me before the show, we have had a couple of different series that have really focused on the injustice of the criminal justice system. So we got that in Serial, the podcast where we talked about Adnan and how he was, well, hell, we don't know whether or not he was technically rightfully convicted or what have you. We are led to believe that he was not, and certainly there is a great deal of evidence and malfeasance that might lead one to believe that he was not. Netflix also introduced Making of a Murderer, where we also got to see how circumstantial evidence and very loose bits of information are used to make life-ending convictions. But it is important to note that in both of those stories, in both of those series, as popular and perhaps influential as they were, both subjects got to take their asses home after they were charged.
And both subjects were,
Khalif did not.
They were also,
he just went to Riker.
Khalif was also not convicted of any crime.
Correct. Both of their asses were.
They were charged. They went through a court of law.
They were charged. They went home, while they went through that process. And then they were convicted and went to prison. We skipped with Khalif. We went from charge to Rikers. We skipped a whole go back home, have a case. Like we skipped bail. We skipped due process. We skipped jury of peers. We skipped all of that. We just went from charge to Rikers to 2 whole years of solitary confinement.
So, yeah, you can find, I honestly don't know how else to wrap up this story, because if you can't, because there are 5 more episodes that will be airing on Wednesdays for the next 5 weeks on Spike TV. Please check it out. Please learn from this. It's sad that we have to learn from the death of a young man due to so many different traumatic events. But if we don't learn from this, it's going to keep repeating itself. And it's repeating itself as we speak.
Yep. We'll be back. Our keynote is bright. I'm excited about it because it is a much needed tonal shift.
So, Winfrey, for this Women's History Month, I personally want to highlight a few women who have really helped bring the Black experience to life, and especially when it comes to film and television.
Yeah, and I think that in Women's History Month, it's certainly important to talk about representation. And so I'm happy to have this conversation.
To start off, one person who comes to mind often for me as an example of, you know, a woman really taking charge of productions and series and creating events that people will remember throughout the years is Suzanne DePaz. She is a writer, a producer, and all around kind of music and television impresario. Probably her biggest claim to fame is convincing Berry Gordy, the head of Motown, to listen to a young group of brothers who were going by the name of the Jackson Five. Hey. And kind of, hey, there you go. And kind of bringing them to stardom. But aside from her, you know, just work with Motown in terms of music, she also pretty much helped shape modern dancing through her production company with Motown, the DePaz Productions / Motown's Productions, when she broadcast in Motown 25 Yesterday and Today. Now, that was a whole concert series celebrating the 25th year of Motown being in existence. And that is also the first time that the world saw a, you know, an older, more mature Michael Jackson literally turn around and start floating across the stage backward.
Hey.
During the moonwalk. DePaz also produced most of the memorable Motown biopics, the Temptation miniseries, the Jackson 5 American Dream miniseries. But she also...
Okay, ain't no, but keep it moving. The Temptations miniseries and the Jackson 5, bruh. I mean, these are two iconic...
Well, when you help mold their careers, it's almost like, oh yeah, I just did a movie about something that I already knew about. But one interesting note, she also was one of the co-writers of the screenplay of Lady Sings the Blues, which starred Diana Ross. But with her own production company outside of Motown, DePaz Productions, if you all ever watch Sister Sister or Smart Guy, at the end of every episode, there was this kind of like dark bluish background, and you'd see DePaz like in the silver letters written across. Yep. And that's her production company. So go back and watch some old Sister Sister, some old Smart Guy episodes. Wait to the very end and see, you know, this amazing woman's name highlighted, you know, as being just a force to reckon with in terms of TV production.
Yeah, or just go back and watch some Sister Sister and Smart Guy.
You will do. And Xenon, can you speak on that television show, Winfred?
Yes. So we were looking at DePaz's credentials, and I saw that she produced Xenon, Xenon the Sequel, and Xenon Z3 for the Disney Channel. Now, for folks like me who watched damn near every Disney Channel original movie coming up, that was, y'all know what this is. This was Xenon, the little blonde hair chick from outer space. I don't really remember the storyline. I just remember that the movies were great and that they were great enough to have three of them made. Now, there are not a whole lot of Disney Channel original movies with sequels, let alone trilogies. So that just speaks to Suzanne's touch.
Pushing it forward a little bit, a few years actually, we have the writer, producer, showrunner, Mara Brock Akil, who worked with, you know, television stations such as Fox and UPN to bring us many great shows of the 90s and 2000s.
So many of them, when you look at her.
Just to name a few, she was a writer and eventually producer of Moesha.
Mo to the E to the...
She had a hand in the production of the Jamie Foxx show.
Here I come, once again, there I go.
And she was also the creator and one of the executive producers of the critically acclaimed and just legendary show, Girlfriends.
My Girlfriends.
And, you know, just, I honestly only saw Kelsey Grammer's name behind Girlfriends. So I was shocked to even see that. I don't know why I was shocked to see that a show revolving about the lives of professional Black women wasn't, you know, somehow written or produced by a Black woman. But I was very happy to find out that it wasn't just Kelsey Grammer pulling a Rachel Dolezal.
I wouldn't be surprised to see a show that did not resonate with Black women about Black professional women being solely done by white men, because I'm sure that's been done somewhere down the road. But this one that did so strongly resonate, you knew a Black woman had to be up in and throughout that thing.
Yeah, and she had a hand in the production of the few of the Black Girl Rocks award series, which, you know, it's all about, you know, empowering Black girls to become, you know, strong Black women professionally and personally. And, you know, one strong Black woman that I'm sure Suzanne and Mara's influence had, you know, had some influence on was Miss Shonda.
Yes, indeed. Now, what's incredible about all three of these women that have been named thus far, their takeover happened on like broadcast television, not some premium cable channel that is solely directed at Black women or Black people, but on broadcast television channels. And with Madame Shonda, this lady has taken a night of programming on ABC with Grey's Anatomy that's been on for a decade. It's been on for a minute. Then Scandal, now How to Get Away with Murder, and every off season it seems like a new Shonda production gets greenlit by ABC, so she has The Catch. And another one coming sometime this year, something about Romeo that I don't recall, to be fair. But this lady has really taken what Suzanne and Mara laid the foundation for and has run with it in this 2010s decade.
Yeah, to give you like some perspective of like how, if you don't already know how dominant Shonda is because you're watching all of her shows, she has had at least one TV series in full production that she has created on the air for 12 years and running, which is crazy. And only showrunners such as Norman Lear, some of you all might be familiar with his work on All in the Family,
or
The Jeffersons,
or Good Times.
Wait, Good Times? Oh my goodness. Or, listen, this is not about Norman Lear, but you all get the point. Shonda is on the Norman Lear levels, say that five times, Norman Lear levels of just giving you program content, except, well, no, with Black faces as well, because I guess Norman Lear was doing a very similar thing.
Yeah, and so it's actually really, really interesting that you bring up Norman Lear's name in relation to Shonda, because Shonda Rhimes has oftentimes said that Norman Lear's dedication to giving Black people representation is what has inspired her dedication to giving LGBT people representation in every one of her titles. I can respect Shonda wanting to emulate that trailblazing element of Norman Lear's iconic career.
Moving on to another type of trailblazer who really did blaze her own trail from one medium to another is Issa Rae, the creator of the web series Awkward Black Girl. You know, went from just doing videos on YouTube to having her own HBO series entitled Insecure.
Yeah, which is racking up accolades in and of itself. It is a show that, you know, really focuses on the nuance and complexity, yet sisterhood of Black women friendships. Issa Rae has been more than just a writer and producer who has gone from YouTube to HBO, but in her own way, she has been a cavalier for so many others. Every week on her YouTube channel, which has, you know, millions of followers at this point, she promotes a web series made by another Black or female or ideally Black female creator.
All three, Shonda Rhimes, Mara Brockakill, and Issa Rae were featured on a 2015 Essence magazine cover entitled Game Changers, just because of their great success they've had over the last decade in really, you know, pushing Black people in work that can speak to the experience of Black people in the office or Black people, you know, in our private homes, and really tell them in a very honest and relatable way.
We could not, however, wrap up a conversation about women behind the scenes and making strides in media without talking about the one and only Oprah. The lady now has her own, pun intended. Oprah has the Oprah Winfrey Network, but of course she started with a 25-year run being Oprah, okay, again, on broadcast television. Through that time, she went on to produce a number of other hugely popular daytime talk shows as well, and eventually decided, hey, I can be done hosting and just do my own thing. This Black woman from small town Mississippi, self-made billionaire, now has her own. And she could do this all by her goddamn self.
So that wraps up, you know, us honoring the incredible women, Black women who have, you know, throughout the years done their best to highlight, you know, the Black experience in many ways, through many facets.
Yeah, and the beauty of this is that it is clear that we will be seeing more and not less of this. ABC is rumored to be talking about extending Shonda from one to now two nights of the week. One that is drama, one that is comedy. Mara Brockakill now has an extended production contract with Warner Brothers. And Oprah continues to have a network where she can put women like Ava DuVernay on with their own groundbreaking and beautiful series. So this right here really does have promise of continued growth, beauty, and awesomeness. That is a great thing.
That is a great thing. And to Suzanne, Mara, Shonda, Eva, and the incredible Oprah, we salute you.
So DJ, who, what, whatever has drawn your attention this week to be duly noted?
Well, who, what, where, when, how, and why are all questions that are a part of my duly noted. When last week, who Remy Ma why not due to Remy Ma's actions, but the reaction to Remy Ma's action. So if you aren't aware, Remy Ma, the rapper who was recently released from prison on, I believe, gun charges or some violent offense, released a diss track over the classic beat from Nas's Ether diss track against Jay-Z, and she entitled her version Sheether.
Mm-hmm.
So it is a 6-minute diss track where she, you know, goes at Nicki Minaj. Remy, you know, talks about how Nicki, quote, talking about bringing knives to a fight with guns when the only shot you ever took was in your buns. And she kind of goes on, you know, criticizing Nicki for getting plastic surgery, although Remy herself has recently gotten some work done. But I found it interesting that she also stated that she saw Meek at the All-Star, and he told her, stop right there. You shouldn't be taking advice, Remy, from people who, one, had failed hip-hop beef. You know, people who took L's in their own beef. You also shouldn't take advice from people who are kind of in the same, you know, legal limbo as you are. Which is that, you know, you all seem to have trouble with the law, you know, keeping to your probation promises. In this diss track, Remy states that, bloodbath when I catch you, real red carpet. Remy, I'm sure as many people on Twitter have pointed out, you cannot be saying these things when you're just being released from prison on a violent offense. Beyond that, Remy, like, if you would have went at all of the new and up-and-coming female rappers, yes, you may have been kind of criticized for going for, you know, smaller fish, but you would at least have given some promotion to people outside of one of the biggest, not even hip-hop stars, but pop stars in the world right now. When you Google female rapper, guess whose name comes up first? Winfrey, mm-hmm. Would you like to take a gander?
Is it Remy?
No, actually. Her name shows up last on the little Google scroll as you scroll through Little Mama, and you scroll through Drezzy, and you scroll through Tink, and you scroll through, you know, Dej Loaf. After all of those people, Remy is listed with no picture. However, when you first hit that Google search button for female rapper, Nicki Minaj is the first person that, as of today, as we're recording, almost a full week after this She Ether was released, Nicki Minaj is still, in terms of the internet, the number one female rapper in the world. I honestly don't think this is healthy for the rap community, especially when it comes to female MCs, because we can never have more than one at a time, almost. The last time we've had a real group of female rappers coming together to just coming together or just being in existence was probably like the Ladies Night song with Missy Elliott, The Brat, Left Eye, even Power 105 host Angie Martinez, who, you know, is a bit shy about her verse, but I think her verse is one of the best on the song. But that's not the point. The point is, how do we get to the place where we're celebrating like uneven rap battles? Nicki has yet to respond. However, and very randomly, Foxy Brown released a snippet of a response. I don't even know how, you know, Foxy Brown got involved, but I guess, you know, since she was one of the last big female rap artists before Nicki, you know, she had to say something because we only have so many. Out of all of these random one-hit wonder rappers who pop up every new hip-hop trend, you know, whether that be East Coast rap, West Coast gangster rap, Southern hip-hop, the surgence of crunk music, the surgence of trap music, we have Nicki, Tink, Dej Loaf, Drezzy, and I apologize for mispronouncing her name because I don't know it because, you know, no one promotes her. We only promote this one rapper who a lot of people don't even consider a rapper half the time. I get what you're trying to do, Remy. You're trying to promote yourself. You and Fat Joe just released an album. You know, you've been on Love and Hip Hop. You've been just really trying to, you know, get your face back out there. And I mean, this definitely did that, but I just really don't see what's going to come of it. Here's the thing. There is a history between Remy, Ma, and Nicki Minaj that I won't go into, because it's just so much in the past that, you know, Remy's jail sentence, albeit terrible, put her out of the picture in terms of the rap game. Papoose really couldn't help her because, you know, he was raising the kids. Let's just say that. But Nicki's reign is just what it was. And to be quite honest, it's not even, like, Nicki isn't even a name in hip-hop half the time that most people talk about, because she's crossed over so much. And she hasn't released music, you know, of her own in a good 2-3 years. 2015. So it's going on 2 years. Either way, like, Remy, you had the All The Way Up single. It was great. You actually went on record with a notable publication to say that female rappers need to stick together and, you know, stop fighting one another, because there aren't even that many of us in the spotlight to get any shine in the first place. It's no use wasting the little shine you have to take down another female rapper. And here we are. I hate to keep comparing it to the Meek Mill Drake situation, because, I mean, it's just, it's too easy. But the difference between the Meek Mill Drake situation and this is that Meek Mill actually came out with an accusation against Drake that he couldn't rap or he didn't write his own rhymes. So that's what kind of made the, you know, Drake Meek Mill beef, if you will, kind of interesting. The two songs that Drake put out, they were club hits. Wasn't one of them nominated for a Grammy, I believe?
What, back to back?
Yeah.
Well, potentially.
Yeah, so, I mean, it's Drake. Who knows? Either way, like, Remy, I just don't see that happening from you. You didn't have Nicki out here saying, you know, F Remy. You didn't have her out here talking about your abortion, which randomly Foxy Brown did in her diss track against you.
No,
that
she
came
didn't.
Out of nowhere. I'll just leave it at that.
Not an abortion, her miscarriage?
Oh, excuse me. Yes, her miscarriage. Again, in the snippet. This is all a mess. It doesn't make any sense. And again, it is not healthy for the hip-hop culture to have some really great rappers, no matter their gender. Remy Ma is a great MC. Nicki is a great MC. Get together and do a great song so hip-hop fans, especially women, especially during Women's History Month. That was the worst way to kick off Women's History Month and the end of Black History Month. Let's start a female MC on female MC war that at this point has been all but one-sided. Duly noted.
Well, yeah. Was that an actual quote that Remy said, that they needed to come together?
Yeah, she. I wish I had the publication where she stated that, you know, it's always been the history of female rappers since the, you know, Roxanne, Shantae, the real Roxanne beefs in the 80s. It's always been this type of, let's put one artist against another. And I think in the 90s, with, you know, people like Missy Elliott and Lil' Kim and MC Light and Queen Latifah all kind of understanding that if we just work together and build, we'll be way more visible than if we just tear each other down. Which you saw with it. I mean, the Ladies' Night song.
Mm-hmm.
It really pushed them to the forefront. That video was amazing. You saw, you know, a group of women just being catered to by some very, very, very beautiful men on a random island somewhere. They weren't fighting. They weren't battling it out on the island. They were just eating grapes. Just eating grapes. That's all we want.
Just eating grapes. There's so much I could duly note this week, but I have to do a follow-up on a noteworthy item from a couple of weeks ago, where I talked about the House passing a bill that would allow those with severe mental illnesses to once again be able to buy guns. The Senate also voted and approved that bill. And on Tuesday, in a closed-door session before his address to Congress, knowing that that's what the news coverage was going to be about all that day, Trump, with not a camera in sight, signed that bill into law. Now, once again, those with mental illnesses can go purchase guns. And I'm going to repeat what I said at that time when I mentioned this before. If, in fact, every time there is an instance of domestic terrorism that is perpetrated by a white person, that white person is then deemed mentally ill, and not that they just did so out of the hatred in their heart or did so because they have a history of violence or did so because their culture perpetuates violence and all of that jazz like they do every single time it is a black person, a brown person, or a Muslim person. If the only thing that is to blame for white terrorism is mental illness, then why the hell did we just allow them to once again be able to purchase guns? If someone could call me and explain that to me, aside from wanting people to be able to go inside of black churches and kill off 9 of us at a time, I'm here. I'm all ears. Come let me know. Please and thank you. I tried to ask this question of my congressman this week on our teleconference town hall, but my question was ignored. Surprise, surprise.
Well, Texas is a big state, so they probably...
Congressman, he has a little ass district right here. Texas District 7, John Culberson, I want you to answer this question for me. Why the hell do mentally ill people need to be able to buy guns? Because you voted for it. I checked. So call me and let me know. Shoot me an email. Respond to my letter, because I have not only tried to ask in the teleconference town hall, I've also emailed, I have called, left a message at the local office and the DC office, and this week I will be sending a letter in the snail mail. So hopefully one of them will get to you and you can answer why mentally ill people need to be able to buy guns. That is all. I just need to understand why the hell people who have already been deemed a danger to others and themselves now need to be more of a danger to others and themselves because they will be armed.
Folks, take some of that passion you just received from Winfred and apply it to your own local officials when it comes to this next 4 years, because we're going to need it. It cannot just be Winfred. It has to be all of us. Well, to end us on a high note, in the great city of Cambridge, where the prestigious Harvard University sits, the university decides to give their 2017 Humanitarian of the Year Award to none other than Robin Rihanna Fenty.
Really?
Yes. Rihanna was awarded the Peter J. Gomez Humanitarian of the Year Award for her charitable donations to build a state-of-the-art center for oncology and nuclear medicine to diagnose and treat breast cancer at a hospital in her home island of Barbados.
Really? Yes. Breast cancer?
Yes.
That is unexpected. That's something I did not know about her, or that she was doing, or that she cared about.
Yeah, so in 2012, she founded a nonprofit, the Clara Lionel Foundation for Global Scholarship Programs. It was named for her grandparents. On top of the donation for the state-of-the-art oncology center, this foundation also provides scholarships for students from Caribbean countries to attend colleges in the U.S.
Okay. Sound like she's doing some work.
Yes, she is, and she states that, you know, she really wants to give priority to the girls and those affected by, you know, the lack of education in the world today.
Well, there is no more fitting high note to kick off Women's History Month. I think we're just going to call it Black Women's History Month.
I don't want to get into the fight with the All Lives Matter crew, but, you know, whatever.
Hell.
This month, we're going to just keep on with the Black History Month. If it's Black History Month, it's so short that I forgot to pay my rent on time. We're just going to extend it, and we're going to make it Black Women's History Month. Maybe that's not a fact that we want to start Black Women's History Month off with, but it's very true.
Hey, first rolled around real quick, didn't it? Real quick. Well, great. I think that wraps up another episode of Duly Noted that you most certainly are going to be listening to. I don't care what my computer or the programs therein try to do to hinder me this week. Please, please do rate, review, subscribe, and share Duly Noted. Hell, tell a friend. Play us in the car when your friends are riding with you. And hell, play us in the car, in your friend's car, when he or she is driving.
Yep, snatch that auxiliary cord right out their hands.
Just snatch
plug
it
in.
Disconnect their Bluetooth and connect yours. Hell, get their phone and download our episodes onto your friends' phones.
Do whatever you have to do.
Also, follow, retweet, and share us on the Twitter at Duly Noted Show. And if you have questions, suggestions, thoughts, concerns, whatever, please feel free to email us at dulynotedshow@gmail.com. As I told DJ before our recording, we hear you.
We definitely do hear you. And we hope you hear us when we say, y'all stay safe.
And keep your head up.